We'd like to welcome everyone here again for this afternoon of exploration of the way that God is working in this world. And as I mentioned before, Brother Frank Abel from Canada is here to speak to us on the first topic, which will be how Europe and Russia combine. And we'll be reading from a really great chapter, Ezekiel 38, as an introduction to his remarks. And Brother Peter Moore will read that for us.
Well, good afternoon, brothers and sisters, young people, friends. Just looking around, I think there's enough gray here to say that I wouldn't be alone in being able to remember in my teenage years, when brethren spoke on this topic to the thrill of all of us. In one particular talk, it was given in Toronto on a place called Palace Pier that jutted out into the lake. There would have been maybe 800 Christadelphians in that hall. And we heard a brother speak about the same topic as I'm speaking on now. And I can still remember it. That's the kind of effect that Bible prophecy has on us. Because this brother was able to illustrate from what he could see back in the 50s that this prophecy was special for our day. It was telling us about the nation Russia, which coming out of World War II was really quite a significant nation in developing weapons of war. And in terrifying people around the world by just the stance that the leaders of the nation took. And so there seemed to be an urgency about it, that we should pay attention to what the Word had to say. And that spirit, I hope, will reign today. Because when we look at Europe and we look at Russia, and we really haven't seen too much cooperation between Europe and Russia, we look through the prophetic word to see what God has to say about it in difference and sometimes in contrast to what the people of the world are saying. But these are special days. Back in the time when I was referring to, we could see at least that the Jews were coming back to the land. And there were a number of people that were thrilling over the fact that Israel was a state. But they never saw what we see today. We have much greater reason to rejoice because the prophet Joel said, "In those days and in that time when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations. And I'll bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land." So these are the things which we now look to. We look to this land. We want to see the indication that God's gathering all nations to Jerusalem to deal with them, as he says in verse 2. And if we remember that just 100 years ago, there was just sand dunes in this area, we might guess that we are privileged people, that we're seeing something that other people, even our pioneers as Christadelphians, did not see. You can only imagine that our witness in the world should be commensurate to what we are seeing. Ezekiel 38, verse 8 says, "That after many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, is gathered out of many people, against the mountains of Israel, which have always been waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them." So we've looked back through history to try to see if there's any other time period since this prophecy was given that could possibly be what's being said here. And history is silent. These days are our days. This prophecy is for us. It's for us to believe. It's for us to use as a means of interesting other people as to what God's word is saying and how we ought to be living because of it. The Jewish nation back in the land. And it's not as if there's a whole lot of very complicated scholarship to this. For people who read their Bibles, they would know that when you read Ezekiel 38, you're reading about nations mentioned in Genesis chapter 10. And when you look at the names, Gomer, Magog, Tubal, Meshech, Gomer, Togarmah, Tarshish, etc., you're seeing the nations that are mentioned in Ezekiel 38, and it makes perfect sense that the reason they're there in Genesis 10 is to help people who are reading their Bibles in Ezekiel 38 to understand what our God's talking about. And then just to look at some of the ancient maps that were drawn up as to where these people went. And you can see it's talking about the land north of Israel. The uttermost parts of the north, we find those nations. And if we looked at a little more detailed map, which would disillustrate, it's by a group, Rand McNally, obviously not Christadelphian, and I have no reason to think that there would be prejudice in this. They make a statement like, the descendants of Gomer probably occupied all this part of Western Europe. So we got Magog, and we got Gomer, and we got Togarmah, we got Meshech, we got Tubal, we got Magog, all these nations are mentioned in this area. This is what the prophecy of Ezekiel is all about. It's just so startling, brothers and sisters, to think that this prophecy, Ezekiel, was written down probably about 2,600 years ago. And to think that any prophecy, anything that man has written, could have relevance to our day in such a degree, makes this book the special book that it is. It has to be what it says it is. It's God's word. It's revealed to people that they might know the days in which they live. Now, there's no question about the fact that God's not writing this to tell us what's going to happen. Well, at least not alone what's going to happen. He wants us to understand that this is his work. This is what God will do. And apart from all the other things that people know God for, when you ask people that may not know much about the Bible what their concept of God is, well, he's a God that knows everything. He's a God that's all-powerful. He's a God that's somehow or other everywhere present. They don't know the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible tells us what he will do. And he says, I will turn thee back to Gog and put hooks into thy jaws. And I will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. This is not accidental. This is the work of God. And he's going to do it, and we might look for his hand in these things. And in many cases, it's something we didn't expect to see. Or again in Daniel chapter 2, where in verse 44, we often refer to this verse. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. Well, it's the God of heaven that does it. It's not that God just foretold us the future. It's that he intervenes to make these things happen. The God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So when we see the various nations of the world, the language groups, the cultural groups, all at odds with one another, and we wonder what the struggle will ever turn out to be like, isn't it nice to be able to read in your Bible that God says, in the days of these kings, he will set up a kingdom on earth. Or again in Zechariah 14, where it starts off, Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. God is working amongst the nations to bring them against Jerusalem. And the city will be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city will go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. So we can't help but notice in all these verses that speak about this time that God's trying to tell us that he is going to do these things. And then going back to Joel chapter 3, I will gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat. Well, what nations? Like, we have to be careful when we read a verse like that, I will gather all nations, as to not see that the all is always qualified in Scripture. It's not as if God's going to gall every nation of the hundreds of nations that are in the United Nations. No, he tells us in the chapter. And he tells us, as we've been able to see the difference between the King James Version and other versions, that this idea of chief is really Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And so much of the versions that have come out in the last little while have made that difference, that it's speaking about a specific nation, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. In Alpha's Israel, page 429, John Thomas illustrates this when he says, Gog of the land of Magog, that is, styling the ruler of Magog by the latter syllable of the name of the country over which he rules. We have seen that Magog is the region extending from the Rus or Russia to the Rhine, comprehending Wallachia, Transylvania, Hungary, and Germany. Of course, the prophecy must be future because the prince of the Rus is the Gog of Magog, and as yet no emperor of Russia has been also emperor of Germany, etc. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's exactly the way we see it. We do not see the exact scene of Ezekiel 38, but we see that many peoples of Europe will be with Russia. Gomer, as we saw it on the map, comprising much of Western Europe, and all his bands, the house of Togarma of the north quarters, and all his bands, many people with thee. So that in summary, in Alpha's Israel, John Thomas was able to say this, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the emperor of Germany, Hungary, etc., an autocrat of Russia, Muscovy, and Tobolsky, and prophesy against him and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, autocrat of Russia, Muscovy, and Tobolsky, and I will turn thee about and put a bit into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth from the north parts, and all of thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them accroted with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, among whom shall be the Persians, Ethiopians and Libyans, all of them with shields and helmet, French and Italians, Circassians, Cossacks, and the Tartar hordes of Uzbek, etc., many people, not particularly named besides. Be thou prepared. Prepare thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled with thee, and be thou imperial chief to them. Now we've had 50 years to examine this. 50 years to watch how this is coming together, to try to see how these nations would actually be put together. And I wanted just to go through a few slides to illustrate some of the things that we had said over the last 50 years about this, and how it's turning out presently. Well, Gog does guard them, and it's interesting how, you know, that picture, more recent picture of how Russia actually does guard themselves, and Russian-speaking people, and other nations. It still wants to be a guard. It wants to be a hedge about various nations and cultural groups that have Russians in them. But NATO and Europe are a barrier to that happening. We see Russia off on the right, and we see the Warsaw Pact nations just gone. That's something that we didn't necessarily expect to happen the way it did. But we see NATO trying to push in against Russia. And we see in the Ukraine and other places where Russia's pushing back. And that's one of the other things we'd like to illustrate, some of the hostility that's associated with that in various parts of Europe. But in 1957, Just to illustrate some of the historical aspects of how Russia has antagonized various nations and how it likes to be seen as a military power, this headline in the New York Times was certainly an indication of a lot of fear amongst Americans. Soviet fires Earth satellite into space. It is circling the globe at 18,000 miles per hour. Sphere tracked in four crossings over United States. And those were the years in those 50s when nations were testing these huge weapons of war coming out of World War II, the atomic and nuclear bombs that were able to kill all life on the world many times over. Like, it was really a fearful time. And with now, the Russians able to fly something right over the top of the Americans, there was a lot of people that were really spoofed about this. And, you know, the Bible had told us that what Russia had to do was work in Europe. It had to unite Europe. It had to have Europe behind it when it went down. It spoke nothing about Russia being part of that. But nevertheless, people, because they did not know their Bible and weren't looking at the things which give us hope, were fearful. And yes, the 5 megaton nuclear bombs that were tested and multiple warhead vehicles that can come down and fake the defenses out, these were the things that were talked about in the 50s and the early 60s. You may remember, some of you would remember, I'm sure, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where Russia was intending to put missiles in Cuba, just off the bottom of the state of Florida, so close to America that the Americans again become very spoofed about this and determined this was not going to happen. So you can see this little picture here of the line that they set up to stop those ships from coming into the Caribbean. And the President Khrushchev finally determined to turn them around and go back home. Now, this particular chart was put together in the 60s. It was more or less what Christadelphians taught 50 years ago about this and how we saw the nation of Russia coming down to the Middle East. We saw them lined up with Europe. We saw the Battle of Armageddon to be fought there. And that chart was a chart that we used in Adelaide. It was used in Brisbane. And since the times of charts have not totally over, but certainly it has been eclipsed by what we presently are using and by transparencies, etc., we don't see this much anymore. But it was really a very interesting and I think a very wonderful time to be alive and working in this capacity, because the way it was done was someone offered a lot of floor space, usually in their house, to lay out some cloth. You get somebody with a good enough ability to actually draw the basic map on there and give some plan to the pattern of what you're going to say in the corners. And then a whole group of young people came in with their paintbrushes and their paint and painted it. And then when we got it up on our platforms, we used to put lights on it to shine at night so that when people came in for a lecture like this, there was an atmosphere. Like, the whole place was just glowing with all these charts of various things that were going to happen. That was 50 years ago. It was a wonderful time to be alive. This is what we said about Russia. You can see with the terms we used. Increasing communist peril challenges the West. We don't use that word much anymore. 23 wars against the Reds. We don't use that word much anymore. 1,000 million held under communism. Domination of a quarter of the world's land area. 20-year average of 1 million enslaved each week. Reds believe they will conquer the world in 20 years. Massive stockpiling of terrifying war weapons. The coming Russian invasion of Israel will plunge all nations into World War III. I know there were some fairly big exhibitions of these charts and lectures given in some of the town halls around Australia. And in Toronto, we rented the biggest building we could pretty well get in Toronto, and had, I think the time we used that, we actually were using transparencies, but we found this subject attracted people. And brothers and sisters, we are not the only people that are interested in this, but I don't think that many people know that this book, the Bible, speaks about this in such a detailed way. And who else is going to tell them except Christadelphians? Who else would expound what we believe and teach about prophecy except us? If we don't do it, then the world doesn't know what we know. Those two brethren, I'm sure, would be known to a number of you. Brother Maury Stewart from California on the left, Brother Prince Mansfield on the right. That was Brother Maury's set on television through the 70s. He had this program, This Is Your Bible. And many people in California were tuned in to listen to that, and certainly there were people who came into the truth because of that prophecy of what Ezekiel 38 had to say about our world. But then the Berlin Wall came down. And I don't know if you ever read anybody about, that wrote about this that ever thought that would happen the way it did. And some people got shifted right off the whole idea of Russia being the one that would come down against Israel because they didn't expect this, that the Berlin Wall would come down peacefully. We always thought that if that wall would come down and the Germanys would unite, it would be conquest one way or the other. We never saw it to be peaceful. But then neither did we see this, that the Soviet Union would collapse in 1990 with Mr. Gorbachev coming on the scene. And you can see in the map there the number of places where other nations also collapsed, at least in their stance against the West. So the Warsaw Pact just fell apart. And it looked like maybe there was going to be peace. And people were just wondering, would this ever happen? I don't think anybody thinks that now. And there's a lesson there, brothers and sisters. Don't get so tied into the news broadcasts, into the magazines, into the TV pictures, into all the files that we get telling us about what the world thinks and the articles that are being written, as to believe that that's where the truth comes from. And the truth comes from the scriptures. And we must, first of all, have a good understanding of Ezekiel 38, that this will come to pass. That's our God, Yahweh, the one who will do, the one who was always associated his name with what he would do. And the Egyptians found that out. When he said, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to do. And it's interesting that in Exodus 15, when it talks about the Egyptians, after they were overthrown in the Red Sea, that Pharaoh thought he would play Yahweh. And he said in one of those verses, what I will do, and I will do this, and I will do that. No, there's only one God that will do it. And all that nation is rising again for is to do what God said they would do. But what a change. What a change from the Brezhnevs, the Khrushchev, and from all of those ancient, or at least not so ancient, but older presidents of Russia. This man, Vladimir Putin, is quite an individual in terms of the world stage. He likes to be seen entering with those gold trimmings and people opening the doors for him, etc. We see him quite often like that. And then just recently, we saw him in what he was doing down in the Crimea, which is quite interesting. When we'll just, this little slide, I want to show you this about the Crimea War back in 1853. But when you see what he's doing here, you can see this man has a bigger vision of Russia than just where the present boundaries are. And so, again, we see Russia in action. Russia's moving. That's the character of the man. That's the character of Russia. That's the same character that we saw in this former Soviet Union. That they would just shoot an airliner out of the sky like this and then claim that they had no part in it. And when people want to investigate it, they will stop them. That's the nature of what we're dealing with. It's interesting to see what happens in the Arctic. You might not be, well, if you read your news, you'll see it, because it's in the news. But it's interesting to see what they do in the Arctic. I just want to read this to you, because this comes from a snippets file, and there's just a lot of very interesting things that are available there. Russia says it has submitted to the United Nations a bid for vast territories in the Arctic Ocean. The foreign ministry said on August 4th this year that Moscow is claiming 1.2 million square kilometers of the Arctic sea shelf. Russia, United States, Norway, Denmark, and Canada have all attempted to assert their jurisdiction over parts of the Arctic Ocean, which is thought to hold much of the Earth's undiscovered energy resources. Russia first submitted such a claim in 2002, but the United Nations returned it due to a lack of evidence. Moscow's latest bid reportedly contains much more data. Russia made a symbolic claim to the Arctic seabed in 2007 when one of its submarines dropped a canister containing a Russian flag onto the ocean floor near the North Pole. Well, actually, it was a Russian submarine that planted it on there, a robotic submarine that actually put it on the North Pole. Now, the North Pole's not anywhere near Russia. But that's the spirit of this nation, that they will go out and they will claim things. And, you know, if you want to dispute it, well, you'll have to dispute it against their claim that we were there first and it's ours. That's the nature that you deal with. These bombers have been going around the Western world and just trying to tell the Western world that Russia knows their boundaries. So four such aircraft probed the Californian airspace on July 4th of this month. Imagine going down to welcome the Americans on July 4th, their holiday, with four military aircraft just off the coast. That's the spirit of this country. Flying around England, they fly across the Arctic, and quite often Canada, with the few little airplanes that they have to go up and intercept these things. So in Zechariah chapter 14, verses 1 to 3, we need, having seen the spirit of the nation, we need to get back onto the track that I will gather all nations against Jerusalem. It's not New York. It's not Toronto, it's not Ottawa, it's not some other nation in the West. It's Jerusalem. That's the city we've got to watch. And that's where the battle will take place, and that's where the city will be taken, and that's where Yahweh will go forth and fight against those nations. So who's interested in Jerusalem? Well, that's a fairly recent picture of the city, pretty built up. But in the old city, as you can see, the big mosque, there's a Latin quarter, there's an Arab quarter, there's a Jewish quarter, and there's a Greek quarter. And Sister Dorothy and I went over there just to sort of look that over and just rent a car and drive around and just see who is interested in this place and where is the presence of Russia in this place. Well, you don't have to look far, because at the foot of the Mount of Olives is this place, the Church of Mary Magdalene. Certainly a Russian, or part of Russia's real estate in Jerusalem, and one of the reasons why they consider they have holy sites in that city. But what is really amazing about Russia that we now see, compared to the Russia we saw back in the Soviet Union, is we didn't see any Russian leader flanked by religious leaders. They wanted nothing to do with religion in the Soviet era. So for years and years, we talked about this without knowing that there would be this transition that would be coming, and the Russian leader would want to be flanked by religious leaders. Well, the question is, why would he want to be flanked? Well, again, from the snippets file, this is going back to May of this year. It's entitled Holy Alliance, Vladimir Putin, the Russian Orthodox Church, and Russian Exceptionalism. And it's in the Forbes magazine. And it says this: when Putin came to power, he shrewdly noted the ROC's, that's the Russian Orthodox Church's, useful role in boosting nationalism
and the fact that it shared his view of Russia's role in the world and began to work towards strengthening the church's role in Russian society. Early in his presidency, the Russia Duma passed a law returning all church property seized during the Soviet era, which alone made the ROC one of the largest landholders in Russia. Over the past decade and a half, Putin has ordered state-owned energy firms to contribute billions to the rebuilding of thousands of churches destroyed under the Soviets, and many of those rich oligarchs surrounding him are dedicated supporters of the ROC, who have contributed to the growing influence of the church in myriad ways. Around 25,000 ROC churches have been built or rebuilt since the early 1990s, the vast majority of which have been built during Putin's rule, and largely due to his backing and that of those in his close circle of supporters. So this seems to be well substantiated, that the leader of Russia sees there's something to be gained in what he really wants to achieve by aligning himself with the Russian Orthodox Church. And hence, he's reinstituted with billions of dollars the building of these many churches. A little later in Forbes, there's this other indication. It says, Vladimir Putin and Alexander Dugin's vision of Holy Russia. Alexander Dugin is an advisor. You might not think that Putin has any advisors, but apparently he does. And it's a vision of Holy Russia, which is shared with the Russian Orthodox Church. It sees Russia's mission as being to expand its influence and authority until it dominates the Eurasian landmass by means of a strong, centralized Russian state aligned with the Russian Orthodox Church, championing traditional social values over against the cultural corruption of a libertine West. Now, I think that's really quite sensational, because there's nothing to be disputed about the libertine West, about the liberties the Western Church has taken. And Russia, and Putin in particular, seems to want to illustrate that he's a champion of those values. And so he's got a strong relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church, which wasn't there before. You see these huge edifices coming up that were largely ruined during the Soviet era. And a lot of money has gone into illustrating that to the world. But pictures like this would you hardly believe. If you were to talk back in the 50 years ago about Russia and the Pope getting together, that would be rather unheard of because of the communistic value. But when you see this, and especially Putin crossing himself so that he can be at one with the Pope, you get an idea that something's afoot. So again, from snippets, just looking a little bit at this, and this is from the Russian Insider, and it's a little bit about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which you may have heard of in the not-so-distant past. It says, and Putin gained firm support and endorsement from that inveterate and most intransigent anti-communist Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Before his death in 2008, Solzhenitsyn praised Putin and stated that he believed Putin's personal acceptance of Christian faith to be genuine. American Ambassador William Burns visited Solzhenitsyn, April 2008, shortly prior to his death, and quoted him as stating that under Putin, the nation was rediscovering what it was to be Russian and Christian. Now that's really quite interesting, because that opens up a whole avenue of thought that we would not have had 50 years ago about what Russia would really do. Russia warming up to the Russian Orthodox Church? Russia warming up to the Pope? What would the Pope, what would the Latin Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church have in common? Well, that's something I'm going to comment on in a little bit. But just another point here before I get to the holy sites is this dominance that Russia has created. Whether there was design in this or whether it was just an economic advantage, surely a lot of money and a lot of work went into getting Russian energy so distributed throughout Europe. And, you know, those of us who have read the news, especially when it gets cold in Ukraine, and they have a dispute about pricing, Russia has illustrated they will turn the spigot off. If you really want to keep on getting cold, that's fine. But if you want to get warm, maybe you should talk a higher price. I mean, it's just fascinating to see the dominance that Russia has by its oil and gas pipelines. Probably of more interest, though, is this gas line here. Like this gas line here, which is hardly visible, is the one that was canceled. And this gas line here, which is coming down and going here and then going into Turkey, then into Greece, then across into Italy, is one of the proposals. Now, they're just proposals. They may or may not. I've seen all kinds of maps of what they think these gas lines would look like. But I find that kind of fascinating, especially with what the Soviets or what the Russians did, rather, up here in Crimea, is that if you're going to have a powerful navy in the Black Sea, you've got to have access to the Mediterranean. You want to get out of there. You want to be able to go out into the Mediterranean and then go down through the Suez and go down into the other oceans of the world. It seems now that all of these waterways become more significant all the time. And with a pipeline running just so close to the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, you might expect that Russia could very well claim, well, we have this pipeline, we have this great interest, we have all this money, this investment, that we want control over maybe part of Turkey and maybe Greece. Isn't it interesting that where the problems are in Europe right now, that they're in Greece, and Greece playing such an interesting role down in that southern part of Europe in order to, you know, to control the access into the Black Sea? Well, have a look at this. Now, this is available as just going on to Wikipedia. You might not think that Wikipedia is very accurate, and it really doesn't have the reputation of being the most accurate, but it's interesting to see this little take on the Crimean War of 1853. It says, the immediate issue involved the rights of Christians in the Holy Land. Now, who would ever have thought that the Crimean War was related to the rights of Christians in the Holy Land, which was controlled by the Ottoman Empire? It involved the control of the holy sites in and around Jerusalem. The French promoted the rights of Catholics. Russia promoted those of the Orthodox. The longer-term causes involved the decline of the Ottoman Empire and the unwillingness of Britain and France to allow Russia to gain territory and power at Ottoman expense. Russia lost, the Ottomans gained from a 20-year respite from Russian pressure. The Christians were granted a degree of official equality, and the Orthodox Church or the Orthodox gained control of the Christian churches in dispute. Russia survived, gained a new appreciation for its religious diversity, and launched a reform program with far-reaching consequences. So we're back in Crimea again. So we might expect that maybe there's some latter-day involvement of these holy sites in and around Jerusalem. And I think that that's one of the things that we should be watching when we're expecting God to gather all nations to Jerusalem. That these holy sites, however you might think, you know, like Christadelphians, maybe going to Israel, would probably avoid going to any of these so-called holy sites. But it is interesting to see what goes on in those holy sites. And Sister Dorothy and I went down to this one, which is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. You have to cross into Palestine to actually do that. And we noted that there's an old building and a new building, the old building being on the right here and the new building on the left. Well, the new building is the Latin church, and the old building is the Greek church. So Russia would be interested in the Greek one, and the Pope would be interested in the Latin one. Now, isn't that interesting? When you see what's going on in other parts of Europe, and you see what the Bible calls, when it talks about, you know, all gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. And here we are, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which is, you know, another site that's of quite a lot of interest, and certainly people want to have control over it. We look at this one, the Church of the Annunciation in Nazareth. And you can see that it's quite modern looking, They're certainly cleaning up their sites and illustrating a real interest in keeping them. Now, brothers and sisters, this is a little bit more of a modern look in the use of a chart. That's what we could do today. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be a whole lot of people on a floor painting it, because it's done with a computer. And it's done in a way that it looks much more exact, much more regular, and much more attractive. But I wanted to draw your attention to this, because this is something that we could do to witness to this present world, and we are trying to do this, and we have done this back in Hamilton. You'll notice that we tried to illustrate this by flags. So you got these flags up here, which are separated from the others. You got the Vatican, you got Europe, you got United Nations, you got China. Well, there's an interesting story about each of those. You go up here, you got Russia, Turkey, France, Germany, Iraq, Libya, and Iran. Well, you might have guessed this is an interesting story about those. We've got Israel, Egypt, and Jordan down here. And then on the bottom, we've got Saudi Arabia, Canada, Britain, Australia, United States, etc. See, there's groupings of nations. And with those flags, it makes a really interesting chart to have out in public. We have all those nations. And that's not just those nations. That's incredible. That a book that was written 2,600 years ago could speak so definitely about our time that you can actually see the flags of those countries somewhere in Ezekiel 38, somewhere in Daniel chapter 11, somewhere in Zechariah 14. These nations are being spoken about in our day. You think we could stand up and tell people that? I think so. And we could show them that if you put those things together, and there's divisions in there. There's groupings of those nations. And that's what we've done. And if you need to have, just a little expertise in that, all you have to do is put a chart like that together. That chart's about 12 feet across, 8 feet high. We took all the flags of those nations and put them in a flag stand. We get a brother to take a flag, come out and put it in a stand in the center, and then tell the people why he did it. Well, he did it because Israel is center to the prophecy of Ezekiel 38. And there couldn't be really any relevance of the other things of Ezekiel 38 if Israel wasn't the nation in the land. Is there a park in Perth? Must be a park in Perth somewhere. We just happen to have this park in Hamilton. This is Gage Park. Gage Park's about a 20-acre park right downtown Hamilton. And what's best about it is that this was given to Hamilton by Brother Gage. 100 years ago, he gave this park to Hamilton. So who would mind if Christadelphians came down and explained why Brother Gage gave this to Hamilton, or something to do with it? So you see, there's freedom to do these things. We don't need to feel that we're going to be stopped by getting out. And I found that when we set that up, or even in setting it up, people were coming close and they wanted to know why that flag was there. Why was their flag there? It might have been a German. Because why would you got the German flag here? Tell me about it. And that gave us an opportunity to sit people down and talk about it, and then pass out leaflets. We've got an exciting prophecy in Ezekiel 38. And what's going to happen in Europe? And what's going to happen with Russia? The news is aflame all around the world. They see it on their televisions. They see it in their internet. They see it in the newspapers. And we have the answers, brothers and sisters. We just got to get out and do something about it. And if we need to tell them this, we'll tell them this. That in the follow-on chapter in Ezekiel 39, God says, I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand. I will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. So people who are fearful of these gigantic weapons and all the things that Russia does to spoof nations and to get them afraid and intimidated, God says, I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand. Again, later on in that verse, or verse 4, I will send a fire on Magog. God will take the battle to Magog, and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles, they shall know that I am Yahweh. This is not just telling people about, you know, what's going to happen. This is telling them what God said he's going to do to accomplish his purpose with his people Israel and with those who believe his word. So why will Russia and Europe come together? Well, they're coming together is certain because the author of the Bible, who knows the future, states that it will happen. And there's a few examples. That would be the first reason. To accomplish his purpose with his people Israel. He will bring them together. So it's really not a great thing that he brings them together, but that he brings them together to do something together, to accomplish his purpose with Israel. Europe will have a reason. I don't know what the reason will be. We've thought many different reasons. We might even recently have thought that it was because of all the gas and the oil that they found in Israel. Who knows? It could be something even more valuable that they will find in the future. But Europe will have reason to invade the Middle East under Russian leadership. And at some stage, they will be attracted to Jerusalem to attempt to take control and divide the spoil. But all nations will find Jerusalem to be a burdensome stone, especially those who rise up against her. And we'll leave it there. Thank you.